Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to Shite Talk, an Irish history podcast. How are you, Jason?
I'm better when I get to do the hello.
I know, yeah, you looked annoyed, and I also waited until you were about to take a sip from your cup before I called on you.
Yeah, that's inside podcasting 101.
What did we want to say before this episode?
We've got loads of live gigs and we need to plug them.
Oh yeah, we've got gigs in Dublin, in Shane on the 19th of February, and then in Cork on the 4th of March. Yeah. And then in Belfast on the 10th of March.
And then and more to follow. Actually, no, I shouldn't say that. We should just say, and that's all you're ever getting. No more Shite Talk gigs ever again. We're selling these three, like, I don't know, like the Guns N' Roses will do their last tour. Or it's like Aerosmith or anyone. You're like, it's the final. You're like, well, maybe.
This is it. Yeah, we've been focused on all the stuff that'll happen after that. But, you know, let's just focus on these three for now. And then we'll figure out the rest of it after that. But yeah, that's where we'll be. And then we've got our second film club episode. We'll be recording that on Sunday. Yeah. And we're watching Excalibur. So you should go watch Excalibur. And then you'll know what the hell we're talking about when you listen to this episode. So this episode will be a free episode for everybody because we've got Brian Lloyd.
Yes, of entertainment.ie fame. Movie Brian.
Movie Brian is going to be joining us for this one. So this will be a free one just to give you a taste of what we're doing behind that Patreon wall.
Yeah, that'll be that's a fair taste then, because we've all these live shows we're doing. If you can't
all
come
the
to
live
any
shows
of them,
yeah,
actually, yes, don't tell them that, because then people won't go to the live shows. No, we're not going to put the live shows up on Patreon unless you're already a paying Patreon member and you've bought tickets. Then they'll all be there eventually when we edit them. Yeah. It's going to be a busy February and March.
Yes, and yeah, we've got some other cool stuff. There's no point saying that, because just buy tickets for those three gigs and just pretend that we're all going to die after March. We all might go into lockdown after March. Who knows?
We are going to die after March.
Yeah.
Some of us might be beforehand. But the important thing is, we don't know when it's going to be, but we do know
that's true
when these three live Shite Talk gigs are happening.
That is true. Yeah. All before the double bank holiday St. Patrick's Day that many of us will not see the other side of. But for now, for this week, here's an episode all about a stamp man.
I don't know. Rashford, I'm sure we'll get into it. Gather around now, you're in for a story. Old tales of lore, all in search of a glory. The history and mystery of lads, lasses and all. Discoveries and voyages, the rise and the fall.
Jason, it was the 1950s. The Great War was over, but the Cold War had just begun. Britain formally recognized Israel and the People's Republic of China right before they invaded Tibet in the year 1950. Apartheid is officially implemented in South Africa. North Korea and South Korea go to war. And back home, after declaring Ireland a republic in 1949, the Costello government has screwed the pooch with Noel Brown and the health service and collapsed the 13th Dáil.
Fantastic. That's a great summation.
There you go.
That's good background there.
That took me, I'd say, 4 hours to write, because I got really sucked into... I think it happened around 2016 was the first year I noticed the sort of meme of like, ugh, 2016, 7 celebrities that I vaguely heard of have died. Worst year ever. Well, can't wait till this is over. And then 2017 was the same. And then the pandemic. And I feel like people have just been miserable bastards for the last couple of years. But you go back to any year and look at the events that happened that year. And you're like, oh, yeah. That's just how the planet is.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't know why it only took you to 2016 to know that people were saying that.
I feel like 2016, it really became a meme where at the end of the year, people were like, oh, goodbye 2016. Come on 2017, as if it would be any fucking different. And 2016 is when I think all those celebrities died and people were like, oh, this is the Armageddon.
Do you know what? You're right, because didn't Bowie die in 2016? That was one of the...
I think, yeah.
He was one of the big ones that kicked it all off, because then people were allowed to... Like, he was important enough that people were allowed to put out, like, heartfelt messages about and not be ridiculed instantly.
Sure.
And now that's reserved for... It's not, I was going to say Norm MacDonald. It's not even, because we have comedians, friends that we've laughed at because of their saying nice things. Saying nice things about a hero who's just passed on. Why don't you go fuck yourself?
Oh, he meant a lot to you growing up and inspired you? Fuck off the internet.
He's the reason that you found your own passion that keeps you kind of like separated from the rest of the doom and gloom of a grey society. How will you go shove it up your arse?
Go in the bathroom and cry by yourself like a real man.
Mm.
Get in the shower so not even you know if it's tears or not.
You always know.
Nah, you always know inside. You push that down, deep, 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 deep down. But, so here's the 1950s in Ireland, all right? So we covered the fall of the 13th Dáil, I don't know, last year. But anyway, Costello gets kicked out. Dev is back in 1951 for his third stint as Taoiseach. And he has to deal with the economic collapse and mass unemployment. Between around about 1952-53, up to 10,000 civil servants marched down O'Connell Street in Dublin demanding a just wage. 500 unemployed men marched on Kildare Street demanding employment, not dole. And 1,000 unemployed people sat on O'Connell Bridge for 15 minutes in protest.
You say that, but at the same time, there was 5,000 lads sat on fences around the country watching Sunday League football games. So they're not protesting. They're having a good time.
They are having a good time. I didn't look at any sports misery for this decade, but I assume nothing much was happening.
I thought you were going to say, I haven't looked at any sports in my life.
Ever.
Ever. That's, yeah.
I doubt many people had a TV or a fence to sit on, but in terms of learning, book smarts, Ireland was not the land of scholars at the time. The dropout rate after primary school was almost 90%. In 1951, 7,800 people attended college.
In 1951. Now, I'll tell you this, they're not good numbers.
No.
Do you know when some people say today that, like, there's too many people in a society getting a tertiary level education, that there's not enough jobs for all of these, like, pencil pushers, basically, that more people should go back into manual trades? That there's a lot to be said for that. But they probably mean more than 7,000 people.
They probably.
That's less than DCU. That's about like 70 or 80% of our entire college.
Yeah, true. And I don't think everyone else in the country was going on to vocational school and becoming carpenters or electricians. I think they were just going straight out to work on the land.
Yeah, I'm trying to push it back. Sure, I suppose it's around the time of our parents, so I should get that in my head.
Funnily, I thought the same. And
but
then,
it's not. It's a few years before.
It's not at all. It's way before. Like, well, I think our parents are probably the same. My dad was born in 1965. But in my head, when I was reading all this, I was like, he lived through... He wasn't born in World War II. He was like, we're about a decade off, I think. But I did the exact same thing, yeah.
Yeah. If you're born before the 80s, you're basically...
He sat through the Blitz, the brave bugger. But I think I said it at the start of the Meagher episode, which also several people have told me is pronounced Mayor.
We did. We got some nice message. Our promoter from the gig in Belfast was on to us telling us that.
That's true. Yes, yeah. And Ali, our promoter from the gig in Shinnay.
Shout out Darren, that's his name. And then and then Ali was on to us as well. That's a weekly thing now, basically, where we do the podcast and then Ali will get on to us and tell us important information that we should have ran by her first.
But we'll get her on. We're going to have her on eventually. And then she can be in the hot seat. You can see how easy it is to, you know, look up how to pronounce things before a show. But last week I was talking about the potato holidays and I was asking my dad about it then since. And he was saying, yeah, I was remembering it right, but it was a very regional thing. Not everywhere had them, but different areas would just have a week off where the children could go and help the family with the potatoes.
Yeah, I think when you were saying that to me, I went out then and I realized it was something stuck in me craw, something stuck in my something about that. And I realized you're right, because in Carlow, a lot of it was like tin and beet, because we had like the beet factory in Carlow town.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what I remember my dad used to always say, that like, because they would never, not so much school, they'd Mitch play in GAA because they'd make money tin and beet or going down and doing all of that. So they wouldn't play. But then because it's a, like a local parochial thing, like for the parish, the priests would find out that they weren't there, go down to the fields and beat the shit out of them.
Yeah, that's when the country was run properly. Because my dad was telling me a story about the principal that I would have had in primary school. He got his job whenever in the 60s. He went down for the interview with the local headmaster. And the interview was basically just the headmaster complimenting my principal on his gas skills. He was a young, fine buck, and he was like, "Jesus, walking." I saw you there the other weekend. That was great, great bit of performance. And the only issue was that my principal already had a job in a different school. And, you know, he had to give such notice before he'd be able to switch over. And the headmaster was like, "Forget about that." And he got the priest of the area where the guy was at school at the minute. He sent him a letter to announce that there was a potato week, so that the school would be out for a week, so that my principal could come and start working in my school. That is when GAA school headmasters and the priests used to run this country.
Oh, it was a better time. I mean, but that's
people, a simpler time.
You know, when a man could get ahead. But like most of schooling is just like glorified daycare. It's a way so that like kids can be at home all day long or out on the streets doing stuff while their parents go make money. And yes, they're going to learn some stuff, but realistically, you probably teach the kids an awful lot of this at home in the space of a few hours. Most of it's socializing and then, you know, not going like acting the gurrier.
Or how to get away with acting the gurrier.
Yeah, so realistically, they probably should still leave maybe, I don't know, I'm going to say 15 days a year just for potato days. Just leave them there still when they're just like, it's a bit much now. Do you know, like Ireland beat Germany, like if it's on a Sunday night in the soccer, lads, we're taking a day off.
Yeah.
We're taking one day off, right? That's a Monday. Is there a problem with this?
I don't think so. Listen, I bring back potato days. That's what I say.
You've already heard my thoughts on too many people are going to college. My next one is too many people are spending too much time in secondary school.
Sweeping reform against education in general. Brennan says, bring back potato time. We've lost touch with the earth. But, well, let's go back to a simpler time when people were in touch with their surroundings. Because the 50s, although education was down and unemployment was up, religious fervor was also at an all-time high. In 1954, the Vatican and Pope Pius XII declared 1954 to be a Marian year, which is a year where you just celebrate the Virgin Mary. And there's no rhyme or reason to this. Apparently, they can just declare it at any time, but it's only ever been done twice in the history of the Catholic Church, in 1954 and in 1987.
Okay, 54, 87. But tell me this. So it's like a Marian year then, or is it pronounced Marian?
It's Mary. Well, it's like M-A-R-I-A-N. It's a Marian year. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Because I was going to say, if the church turned around like, this year is a grand old year for getting hitched, like a Marian year.
It's a Marian year, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
We'll be doing 2-for-1 offers on all the churches up and down the country. So I was trying to figure out why this was, and I couldn't. It's just like they announced a fire sale. It's not as if they weren't doing well or anything. They're just like, this year, it's a Marian year. Big celebrations. Pull out all the stops.
I mean, I'm okay with it. If more industries did that, where it's like, this year, we're going heavy on tech. Everyone's buying new phones. And then we took a year off from buying phones. And then it was like, this year, we're really into running mountains and going swimming.
Well, apparently, so during the 1954 Marian year, 30,000 people marched around Dublin, parading for Mary. Apparently a lot of, you know, when you drive around the countryside, you see an awful lot of shrines to the Virgin Mary, just like on roadsides.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
But apparently a lot of them were put up in this year. People just went mad for Mary for a year.
I was going to say, it's not like a centenary or anniversary or whatever the term would be for her.
No.
Like,
And it had never been done before. It was the first one since the Catholic Church started. Nothing had happened. They were just like, you know what? This year, Mary.
Yeah, but if there's that many Mary statues around, what do you think the odds are that somewhere in Europe the church paid to make too many like plush toys, basically, like the equivalent, and then they were like, really need to get rid of these. And you're like, how?
Yeah.
Like, we're gonna do. It's the same reason, like when we used to have a bunch of leprechaun stuff left over from an old Samhain, that then we turned around and we're like, what about March 17th?
Yeah.
What if we just tell everyone and then just sell all of this shit?
Yeah, you think someone in the Vatican put a zero in the wrong place while they were making an order for Virgin Mary statues and they ended up with way too many. Like, I got this now. Promotional idea. But yeah, so that was 1954. It was the same year Dev booted out, Costello back in again until 1957. But so both, they're just switching back and forth, and both governments are like bringing in different versions of austerity to try and get themselves out of the budget troubles. The economy is mostly agricultural based, but mass youth emigration and collapsing milk prices puts a big strain on agriculture.
Put a bigger strain on the others.
Yeah. In the decade between 1951 and 1961, 408,000 people emigrated. And this is back when the population of the country was about 2.5. I think it was around about 3 million.
Yeah, this is, if for anyone who can't quite put that together in your head, think Euro 2012, when Ireland had games.
Yeah, when everyone just tipped off.
About 20% of the country just up and vanished.
Yeah, or Italia 90.
Yeah, pretty much any. And does that happen as much with the Rugby World Cup? Maybe think that's more expensive and it doesn't go on half as long and you're not as interested in the sport. I don't know. But
yeah,
like, because that's
it's a lot of factors.
Yeah, it's really a thing. Same as like when they used to talk about like MMA and Irish lads used to go over to watch McGregor when in his heyday and how many people went over. None of it compares. Like, even if cumulatively put it all together, nothing compares to just like, or 2016 in France. In Paris, and the streets are just awash with green.
Ireland doing marginally well in football tournaments.
Oh, no, we've qualified. That's it. The door's been opened now. That's like, it's like inviting a vampire. You're like,
But yeah, when the first program of economic expansion was introduced in 1958, its author, the Secretary of Finance, Dr. Ken Whittaker, said, "The common talk amongst parents in the towns, as in rural Ireland, is of their children having to emigrate as soon as their education is complete in order to be sure of a reasonable livelihood." Which is hard to get into that sort of mindset.
It is. I was watching that CR video vault. I don't know if I sent you the video there last week, but it's of like in the early 80s, I'm going to say. But it's a town, again, I want to say out in the west, maybe it's Mayo. Now, I realize now that this story starts at me going, it's maybe this thing and maybe at this time, and I've completely forgotten what happened. But it's a town out there and they're talking about just everyone. They go and interview like the kids in secondary school and it's the six-year students. And they just go, anyone put up your hand if you see a future for yourself in Ireland? And like four people out of a class of like 30 put their hand up and they're like, okay, now it's time to go ask the girls' side of the school. And then they're like, even less, they're like, nobody's staying. And how many people would like to? And that's the interesting thing, because so many lads put their hands up, same with like a lot of girls as well, but so many people actually put their hands up as in to stay. Whereas if you were to say that now, to turn around to like 18-year-olds, do you want to go off to New York or California or Chicago? You're like, maybe. Yeah. Or about Sydney or Melbourne or London. And people are like, I could probably just tip on now. And these are like 18-year-olds that are adamant. Like, I don't even want to go to Dublin. I don't even want to go to Galway. Galway's too big of a city for me. The bright lights. What am I going to do? I won't be able to see anything.
I know my way around the local fields. I'm shifting a girl from down the road. I can get a pint for £2 and change down the local. Why would I leave?
Yeah.
I'm going to make senior team next year.
Yeah, you've got a good 10 years of your football career left in you.
Yeah. But I don't know if the numbers here, but basically when this happened again in the 1980s and everyone had to emigrate, people were a lot more educated. But this time around, we went through the education stats there. But by the end of the 50s, the country was almost bankrupt anyway. And just for a bit of flavour, in 1956, the Suez Canal issue meant that fuel price had to be rationed for about 2 years afterwards. The same year, the IRA reignited the border campaign and started attacking barracks and government buildings around the north, and then just like ramped that up over the next two or three years, leading into the troubles in the 60s. In 1951, Mayo started the curse, winning the All-Ireland for the last time before pissing off that priest. And in 1952, Samuel Beckett published Waiting for Godot. So, a bleak, miserable decade.
It was. I say Godot.
Yeah, either or.
And there's a few other things of what you said there. Do you think that there's a military station in America called the Obama Barracks?
Maybe. I would hope so. Yeah. If not, we can build it in Offaly or wherever Moneygall is. Yeah. I find this suit, I guess everyone's, rightly enough, is complaining about fuel prices now. And it's like record highs. But just like trying to get the flavor of any decade, and you're like, oh yeah, it was always fucked.
Yeah.
Fuels were at record highs then because Egypt, France, and Israel were fighting over, or in England, were fighting over control of the Suez Canal, which is the same canal that got blocked last year by that ship that went sideways. So it's good to see that after, 70 years, it's the same issues. If like a small canal in between Eastern Africa and the Middle East gets blocked, then the whole world comes to a standstill.
That's fair. I mean, I guess Texas has their own oil. That's why it's so cheap over there, and gas prices and everything.
Yeah.
Because that's the big difference when people ask me about... I only drove a moped as well, so it was like $2, $3 a week max is all I was going to have to put into the thing. But like,
Jesus.
That would have cost me so much money here.
Oh yeah.
Like so much money. It is legitimately 3.5 or 4 times cheaper.
I think the cheapest fuel I ever saw was in Iran, and they've got like maybe the leaded kind. I can't remember
green
what the
diesel.
Is, but it's the very volatile. It's like straight from the ground, pure.
Oh.
So it's dirt cheap, but also likely to explode. I remember every time we stopped in a car, they'd have you... Remember in the old days, like you couldn't use a mobile phone while you're filling the petrol station?
Yeah.
Even though it still says that now. It's like, don't use your phone while you're filling up a tank. Over in Iran, they're like, you can't stand in the petrol station. We'll fill it up and you have to go stand across the road over there.
Wow.
Which I remember thinking, like, if it does blow up, standing across the road is going to be fuck all good. And even if I do miraculously survive, I'm now just stuck in the middle of a desert in Iran beside a burning plume of oil coming out of the ground.
Well, I was going to say that's one of those... if you were to tell me that story and say that I was there and some lad told me that there was like exploding fuel here, so I had to get out of my car and walk across the other side of the road, and then he filled it up for me, hopped in the van and drove away.
Oh yeah.
That I would just as likely believe that, because when you're in another world, like a different country, it's basically a different world, completely new culture, that could have just been someone getting ready to rob you, or that is actually just the culture.
Oh, it wasn't filling up my car. Like, we were all in a taxi, because the easiest way to get around, because fuel was so cheap, was just rent a taxi for like 2 days, and it would cost you like 20 quid.
Oh, nice.
But back to 1950s, miserable doom and gloom Ireland. I've set the scene, it's a bleak place. And into that bleakness comes Dr. Paul Singer. Singer was born in Bratislava in 1911 in modern-day Slovakia, I guess, but what at the time was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His family survived World War I, and they all moved to Vienna when he was a teenager. He then went on to college in Switzerland and got a doctorate in political and social science. His family were Jewish and decided to get the fuck out of Europe because they saw the writing on the wall. So they moved to London in the 1930s and they set up a family brokerage business there. By 1954, Dr. Paul Singer had arrived in Ireland. He was a large man of 19 stone with a big black beard. So I watched the documentary. Did you ever see the Scanall series? I think it's in Irish, but I think it's an RTE documentary as opposed to Tuaisce Cathair. Scanall is the Irish for scandal. So it's just a series of like scandals. It's quite good.
Is it? It's Oscailge though?
It is. But like all of those Irish documentaries, you know, it's like lots of people are being interviewed and they can't find enough people that actually speak Irish.
Oh, so they just get people to regularly speak English. It was at the same, Tina G used to do that with their rugby coverage, and they were like, we're going to do rugby, but Oscailge, and then they'd be like, right, well, we've got these two lads, and oh shit, we've just two Gael goers in the entire nation. Jerry Flannery speaks English, and people like him, so how about that?
Yeah, well, that's what David Williams is in this one. And he does one or two lines in Irish, but I've a feeling they're fed to him.
Oh, yeah.
Because he speaks English for a lot, yeah. But a lot of them, they have so many talking heads where it'll cut back to someone. A lot of it's so unnecessary because they'll just cut back to, like, a guy who would be like an accountant. He's like, yes, you need money to make a business run. And then I'll just cut back to the story. It's like, just why'd you hire that man? But anyway, so I watched a documentary about this. And in the documentary, they keep referring to Paul Singer as like, he was a larger-than-life figure. He was a big personality. He was a very fat man.
He was a very big man. 19 stone is pretty 19
big. 19 stone, yeah. And he looks like Penn Jillette, you know, the magician?
Yes.
Of Penn and Teller?
Yeah.
That's what he kind of looks like. And yeah, so I think the only reason I'm bringing his weight into it is because it adds to the sense of... Because it's the 1950s. People will hear...
Weightist. I get it. That's fine.
Weightist, yeah. But I guess it's like... It's
I
not
see,
like back
I see what
in the
you're doing. You're setting him up. We've got the evil guy now. This is our... We've got an antagonist.
Well, no, it's not a Disney film. But as in, to see someone... Irish people weren't starving in the streets, but you wouldn't see a large man like that commonly.
No, they were being
then.
Eaten
it
in
was
the
a
streets
sign,
by this man.
Yeah, he was a gourmand. It was a sign of wealth. And he showed up, he was wearing tailored suits. He drove a nice car and smoked big cigars. He was a swarthy, European-looking businessman.
Mm-hmm.
He would have stood out, I suppose, walking in the streets, chomping a big cigar. He's Tony Soprano, basically. In contrast, Jerome Shanahan ran a family-owned auctioneer business called Shanahan's Auctioneer House in Dunleary, where one fine day in February 1954, upturned Dr. Paul Singer with an opportunity. He wanted to sell stamps. Rare stamps. But he needed investors with money and a place to sell them. So how much do you know about philately? Philately? The collection of stamps.
That's what that word means? Okay. Apparently. I was going to say something very different. Not so much licking stamps as...
blowing something.
Yeah. Philately.
Yeah. A philatelist is a stamp collector. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but I also don't care.
Okay. Why do you think they wouldn't have changed the name of that hobby over the years? You'd think at some point over the... Like, if the idea of, like, collecting coins was called a conolinguist.
If you're a coinolinguist.
Yeah.
Well, do you know anything about stamp collecting? Have you got a stamp collection?
No, two things. One, I collected the 2003-2004 Invincible season for Arsenal when they went undefeated in the Premier League. That stamp, but like the sticker books.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I completed that one time. I went up to Dublin, got the final sticker to mark the whole thing off. Giant book, way too much money was spent on it. I was so happy with myself. Left it at home that night. My brother wrote dickhead on the front cover.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was great. And then the other thing, and stamps, not like dedicated. What's the individual porn or whatever? I remember hearing in John Ronson's Butterfly Effect, that the radio documentary, about now that there's no money in porn anymore, apart from if you have people who are really specific what they want. So some guy, completely anonymous, sent someone a stamp collection, say worth 50, 60 grand, and then another 20 grand on top of that to destroy all the stamps while they were wearing stilettos and getting naked and then calling them a little bitch.
Okay.
So if it's that, if that's where this story's going, you're dead right. I am interested.
But is that what FinDom is? Or is that a subsection of that? Financial domination? Just having someone destroy money for you. Just yes, this is so stupid. And I love it.
Well, I mean, you're discussing relationships and it's the same outcome.
Just get it over with quicker. Well, speaking of dumb and stupid, I don't know. I didn't know much about stamp collection, really. I did know there's an insane amount of money in it sometimes. The British Guiana one set magenta sold in June 2014 for 10 million. That's one stamp.
Mm-hmm.
The same year, a block of the inverted Jenny, just an upside down plane, sold for 5 million. So stamps with misprints are worth an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think the British Guinea is worth so much because it was, I don't know, the post office was only around for a weekend or something. Basically, they're stamps and they can fetch an insane amount of money.
Yeah, I've never understood it, but fair play to people that do like it, because there's so many countries with so many stamps and so many different years.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's just, I just have absolute...
I can see most people having absolutely no interest in it. I like vintage camera lenses. I collect them. That's my thing. But I use them.
But at least they have a sort of inherent, or they have a use.
Yeah. Whereas I can also use them to make money while I'm working with them. And even without that, I enjoy having them and I can use them for like personal projects. Stamps are just sitting there.
Yeah.
For some reason, I just have that idea. You know, Father Ted, when he goes back to the priest, the Nazi priest.
Yeah.
That guy.
It's full of Nazi paraphernalia.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, yeah, that would be weird to walk into a room like that and one guy who's just completely obsessed with Hitler and Nazis and stuff. But also, very interesting, at least. At least you could, like, no matter who's coming into your home, you could be like, do you want to see my Nazi room? And then if it's me or you, I assume, we're going to be like, yes, I 100%. Why didn't you bring me in through the Nazi, the side entrance? It was called the Rhinelet.
Yeah. Oh, just go straight there.
Like,
yeah.
I want that. But this.
Where is this Nazi room? It's the third door on the Reich.
Sometimes I forget that we do a history podcast.
Or a comedy podcast. We just forget about both those aspects. But, well, listen, right. You and me mightn't be into it, but a lot of people are into it. There's a lot of money to be made in it. And Dr. Paul Singer, he was into it. So he invests £100 into this stamp venture and he gets the Shanahans to match him on that. His idea is he's basically just going to take the money, buy a rare stamp collection and then auction them off individually through the auction house. So they put ads in the national newspaper about it, auction off these stamps, and they sell for a profit.
Are you describing like an NFT?
We'll get into that at the end, I think, but this is why I wanted to do this episode now, because it's... Listen, we'll get into it at the end. But
am I finally going to learn what NFTs are?
But so the first time out, he made some money off these stamps. So Singer goes at it again.
He'd take the stamp off of any man's back.
Buying a larger collection of stamps outside of Ireland and then selling them off individually through Shanahan's auction house. So auction houses are meant to auction off third-party goods, but they wouldn't typically sell their own goods. So you're supposed to auction off someone else's stuff. You're not supposed to sell your own stuff. So it probably gives us a false sense of grandeur to these stamps that they're being sold through an auction house.
Yeah, but now, so they bought the stamps from him.
They've bought the stamps together with him. He goes and gets them and they pitch in and then they sell them for
him. But how does he, so he didn't own them already beforehand, then he's gone to the bank.
No,
he's gone
to
the auction house looking for capital. Okay, that's it. This is like the Dragon's Den.
He's Dragon's Den in it. He's like, people love stamps. They're not just for posting anymore. You put them in the little case, you put them on your wall. I don't know. People pay money for it. So that went well for a while. And then in 1955, Singer called the Shanahan team into his office and pitched them his multi-million idea.
Well, hold on. But okay, so before you go on, let me get this right in my head. So he's gone to an auctioneer to say, I have something that's going to be worthwhile for you to auction. I can't afford to buy it. Why don't you buy it?
Mm-hmm.
And have they gone in 50-50? We don't know.
They've gone in. The first one, they both put £100 in and they've gone in 50-50 and then Shanahan sells them off through the auction house for a profit.
Okay.
But now he's wrapping it up and he says to them, this is my multi-million idea. We get the people of Ireland to invest in Shanahan stamp auctions. So they advertise it again in the papers as an investment opportunity for the public with a guaranteed return. They said that the stamps would be priced so high that even if they sold them low, they'd still be making a profit. So you, the investor, would be guaranteed your money back and then some.
Mm, that's what I love it when investment opportunities pop up in the newspaper and it says guarantee.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Also, I don't know why, I doubt they said in the newspaper that like, we're going to be selling them so artificially high that we're bound to make money. Hopefully no one who's buying them is reading this. So initially the offer was for a £50 investment for 3 months. And then it quickly dropped to £10 for 4 months. So you get your money back after 4 months with a profit of about 20%. Guaranteed.
Guaranteed. I like the concept.
It's a great concept.
Guaranteed
people
money.
People like stamps. People need stamps. Guaranteed money. So he's targeting a lot of people. So you got like £10. It's a lot of money for the time, but it's not like out of the reach of, you know, like it's not thousands. It's enough money that you are tempted to put it into this scheme. And then again, guaranteed. 20% back after 4 months.
Yeah, it's good money.
Good money if you can get it.
Which you definitely won't be able to because this is a scheme.
Well, yeah, it's a scheme. A get-rich-quick scheme for getting rich quick. He's throwing extravagant parties, Jason, in the auctioneer house and in his home in Fox Rock, which I assume was as impressive in the 1950s as it is now in terms of Dublin neighbourhoods.
Yeah, I doubt that's ever changed.
No. So he's bringing in potential investors. He's got caviar, champagne, the biggest stars of the day in terms of entertainment. I'm talking the Edmundo Rosses.
Oh, they were. I thought that was a double act. Caviar and champagne.
Caviar and champagne. They had some hits back then, let me tell you.
It was like, we can't get away with touring minstrels anymore. How about one minstrel?
And a bottle of champagne. I guarantee they wouldn't have had an issue with that. I'm pretty sure that they were showing minstrel shows on RTE up until the 80s here. But he was bringing in, he hired the Abbey players to stage a one-act play for his guests. And French cabaret singer Jean Sablon, that's right, the Jean Sablon, was brought over from Paris.
The Jean Sabler?
Yes, I guess so. He was inviting politicians. Everyone was lammed up to the nines, and he was making it into the papers then for his big parties, which made people trust him more. Who is this Yugoslavian man who can throw all these lavish parties? He's selling stamps, you say? I want a bit of that business.
Mm-hmm. Yugoslavian, we're saying now.
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't... When did Yugoslavia show up?
Yeah, I'm trying to think, when did it leave? It left in the late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah. Listen, he's a Central European man. He's a worldly man, and he's making money. Hand over fist. In the documentary, again, it kept talking about like how clever he was to make people like him. He's like a cartoonish.
It's the good old-fashioned lie to them, pretend that you're rich and wealthy. And then it's like, you know how much people love the Great Gatsby? Like, well, same deal.
But it's almost...
People are attracted to wealth and success.
Cartoonish how... I guess people still fall for it these days, but like... He's just like a big man throwing big parties, smoking cigars, and everyone's like, Jesus, they just seemed hoodwinked pretty easily. So, from that Scannon documentary, as David Williams said, nothing undermines your financial judgment like the sight of your neighbour getting rich.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Also, because I was going to say that, like, I know other countries must do it as well, but I know that I definitely do it, and being Irish, I'm going to assume that we all do. But, like, it is a common thing when someone has a lot of money or is doing well for themselves that you go, or even just has like a great looking girlfriend, and you're like, Jesus, I wonder, what job does he have? Yeah. What do you do yourself anyway? And then you realize, well, it's not so much the job they're doing. Obviously, that's a part of it, but it's the person who could do that job to get to that level of success.
Mm.
That like, oh, what is it you do? Oh, you're in coding. All right, well, I can't read the code. And I hate computers and technology. I like pens and papers, so I don't think that's a viable option for me.
Yeah.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
But stamp buying, it's a viable option for everybody. Anyone can do it. And people are making money off it. They're getting their guaranteed money back.
Yeah, but this is you're saying this like Sean Quinn was guaranteeing money.
Why would you bring up that con man into a conversation about what was the best business opportunity in the late 1950s?
Did Sean Quinn buy stamps?
Yeah, Quinn stamp. So by 1958-59, by the end of the 50s, singer's ready to take it up a notch. He starts offering people a chance to join syndicates where you pool your money with other investors, so that would let them buy bigger, rarer stamp collections abroad. Shanahan's and Singer would take their cut for commission, and then you and the other syndicate members would get your money back plus a dividend. Guaranteed.
He's saying that now at the end of everything.
Because it's a sure thing. The more people that invest into it and the more people get their money back initially, the more they tell their friends and the more the news spreads and they're like, Jesus, there's money to be made.
What you're describing now is a pyramid scheme.
Like what the Egyptians did.
Yeah, when they were selling pyramids, this is the exact same way. They were like, we start small, then eventually we'll start buying bigger pyramids abroad.
Please.
And then they never saw that money.
If you could hold all your questions until the end of my presentation about this new product that's going to change your life. Well, there's one fella in the documentary said, like, the attitude at the time, because once people start saying, and they start showing you the money that they're making, and again, the country's broken, it's ours, but here are people making money, and he was saying that a fever took over people, and the attitude was like, sell what you had, sell the chair, sell the bike, sell the wife, she'll get it all back, 20% plus.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1958, Singer sets up his first millionaire auction in November, and newspapers all around the world at this stage are reporting his auction and his legendary parties. I think the one to celebrate that, he had 200 bottles of the best champagne for 200 guests, caviar ordered from Russia, and ladies of the night flowing in from Paris.
Prostitutes.
I don't...
See,
probably.
I told you, stamp porn. It's all happening. It's, his giant scheme in the end.
This was it, yeah. Just get people loaded on... I don't know what Irish people wouldn't have wanted, caviar or champagne. He could have bought us over with a fleet of pints.
Yeah, what would you put in the 50s for Irish people to get them impressed?
Caviar and champagne, apparently.
I suppose, yeah, probably would be that, just because it's a like, classic thing anywhere. But if also, if you had to put like little bits of bacon on top of sausages.
Yeah.
Or have you wrapped sausages in rashers?
Yeah, that's always a thing. Or
bacon is pretty good. Oh, yeah, bacon on donuts.
Oh, even donuts in general. Food, basically, yeah. That wasn't boiled cabbage.
God.
Have you ever had caviar?
I haven't, but do you know what I'm having for dinner tonight?
Boiled cabbage.
You're dead right.
Excellent.
I'm going to be putting brown sauce over my ham, just pretending to myself, the finest caviar. What's this, a can of harp? Why, this is the fanciest champagne. Do you know what they say? If you don't get a can of harp actually from Dundalk, it's not. It's just called fizzy piss water. It has to be harp. To call it harp, it has to be brewed in Dundalk.
In the harp region. You'll just be there with your eyes closed, dreaming of all the money you can make off stamps after this. But, so yeah, this sale is making like international news, because Singer himself is getting big on the international stamp scene. Jason, I've seen some scenes in my time, and by God, the stamp scene, scheme scene, is one hell of a scene. When he'd come back from these trips abroad to buy stamps, he'd be met at the airport by the Shanahans, and they'd be like giving him big applause and giving him the red carpet treatment, there to see his latest collection of stamps. Even at the time, like air travel at the time, would have been the pursuit of the wealthy. So it was just another fancy showing off thing he was doing. I don't have the figures here, but when I was looking at events of the 1950s, must be 1952 in March, a plane crashed coming back from a Welsh rugby match with a load of Irish fans, and a load of people died. And then the following year, an Aer Lingus plane crashed over the Snowdonia Mountains in Wales. And I just started seeing like all these, you'd be stone mad to get in a plane in the 50s. It seemed like there was loads of crashes.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think I was only reading, what's that, Outliers, the Malcolm Gladwell book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was reading that there this week, and there's a whole chapter set about, like, Korean Air, I think it was. They had a bunch of crashes back in, like, the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
And, yeah, it was like, even then, it was very fucking dangerous to be on an airplane.
Yeah.
Just in general, it was very dangerous. We really only sorted this out in, like, the late 90s, early... whenever they got rid of Concorde...
Yeah.
And then when they were like, let's just try and travel at like a decent clip here, let's not go mental. They said like 50% of crashes are down to just planes being late and pilots trying to catch up on times. They're like, just take it easy. Just 5 minutes.
No one's in any hurry. Come on. Take the long way around. So yeah, he's a big wig on the international stamp scene now. In 1959, he managed to buy a share of the Burroughs stamp collection. As you well know, Jason, one of the most famous stamp collections in the world, valued at millions.
It's currently what it's the only stamp collection I know of.
Fair enough. I did some bad maths on this, but basically, so at the time he bought 20% of the collection for 350,000 punts, which just shy of 10 million today. Big money.
350,000 punts is just shy of 100,000 gambles in modern day money.
Well, so I think at that rate, the whole collection would have been worth 1.75 million, which is about 48 million today. And what I'd read is that he had the option to buy the whole thing. So he was going to buy the whole thing in installments, this massive Burroughs stamp collection. He was going to buy it all for $6 million at the time, which is around about 2 million punts, which I think is a bit overvalue what it was worth. But that's the sort of big wig he was. Whatever the maths on it, anyway, this is a legitimate, like, huge collector's item.
20% guaranteed.
It's guaranteed. So these are actually like valued stamps that do sell for a lot of money. And he is making the first move now of buying over the collection in order to auction them off again to the people of Ireland. But on either the 8th or 9th of May, the night before the first scheduled auction of the Burris stamps, someone broke into Shanahan's auction house. The burglars took what's now going to be the second stamp collection you've heard of, the Lombardo Venezi collection, which Singer had bought the month before. But when everyone arrived the next morning into the office to see that they'd been robbed, Singer told them, "Don't worry about it. It's all grand. Sure, we're insured by Lloyd's of London. The whole thing will be covered."
I'm going to guess someone let the insurance slip, or else like they just never paid it.
There was no insurance. That was a lie.
Okay.
So the Gardaí are brought in to investigate the robbery. All of a sudden, they start asking questions that no one had bothered asking
before.
You think
you start handing out 20% dividends to every single member of a collective if you're doing stupid things like buying insurance?
No.
Well, hold on then. Now that you're saying that he lied about the insurance,
yeah,
it's making me think he lied about even getting these stamps abroad at all. He got them here.
This is the moment, and
they're real. Let's not jump the ship here and say like they're fake. No, we've got a lot of money invested in this.
Oh yeah,
but I'm just saying that there's something unscrupulous about this man.
This is the moment in the documentary where like it sort of zooms in on his face and the colors go negative.
Yeah,
well, it was all fine until it wasn't.
Dum dum dum. I was going to do the Law and Order. Dum 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 dum. Law and Order stamps. But this is Ice-T. He's like, "Man, give me 10 stamps. I'll get you $1,000 on the street."
Just snorting bags of stamps, being like, "Ah, that's counterfeit shit."
He's just licking them and then going, "No, not that one." No, none.
Ooh, that Colombian glue make it stick real good. I'm sending poster out of space. What the hell are we talking about?
That's... I don't know, casual racism, I forget.
Yeah, but no, that was my impression of the other guy.
The other guy, yeah, they all look the same to you, these stamp collectors.
But so the Gardaí are brought in to investigate the robbery, and all of a sudden people start asking questions that no one had really bothered asking before, I think. Who was Paul Singer? Why would a man pay $250,000 for a book of stamps? How many of these would I need to stick on a letter for next day delivery to Buncrana? What the hell's going on here? So,
who are we selling these stamps to?
Well, yes. So rumors start circulating that the robbery was an inside job. Or maybe the robbery was a setup to make up for the shortfall in the stock that they had. Maybe there was no stamps at all in the first place. And then, like all good Ponzi schemes, it started to crumble. Investors began looking for their money back, only to find that the money was gone. At some point, people figured out that his big family brokerage firm in London had gone bust years ago, and he'd been in massive debt when he arrived in Ireland back in 1954. And after the Gardaí investigated the books, they arrested Paul Singer and the Shanahans on suspicion of defrauding investors. In court, Singer said...
I thought you were going to say they started looking through the books and realised that a lot of the pictures in these books are... Well, they're the exact same as our stamps.
All these stamps are upside down and misprinted, so I threw them out. They're worthless. But yeah, so when he's up in court, Singer said that he'd spent the missing money on stamp collections abroad, but he couldn't produce any receipts or verify any of that story. You think he was going for like...
Or showed the stamps. No. Could he show the stamps?
No, he could not. I think he was going for the shift of the girl on holidays approach. No witnesses, no corroborating evidence, but you have it on his good word. Why would he lie?
Well, I trust him.
Yeah.
He's a big, large man with cigars and money and stamps.
Well, he may have all that, but there was still...
I'm thinking of, do you know, I know you said he has a big beard. I've decided to omit that now from
sure.
My visual representation. I'm thinking of your man in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the salesman.
Oh yeah, John Goodman's character.
John Goodman. For some reason, I can only think John Candy.
Oh,
yeah, John Goodman. I'm thinking him.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's a big portly man who's a con man.
That is he is. I've seen John Goodman with a beard in... Community, maybe.
The Big Lebowski.
The Big Lebowski.
Flight. Does he have a beard and Flight?
10 Cloverfield Lane.
That's very good. Now we're just naming great John Goodman movies that he also has beards in.
But yeah, you're right. He kind of does look like that. But in the investigation of the books, they figured out that there was £1 million missing from the company, And the investigation found the missing money in some Swiss bank accounts that were in singer Paul Singer and his wife Irma's names, as well as a Canadian one that was in his mother's name.
Oh.
So they also found evidence that the Shanahans had been buying their own stamps at auction using false names in order to keep the prices up.
They were, it's all beginning to unravel. Yeah. You found the thread that's going to pull this whole story apart. Well done, Kevin.
Well, I've solved the mystery. They also saw in the books that the auctions weren't generating enough money to pay investors. Instead, new investors were paying the dividends of early investors in a sort of reverse funnel trapezoid plan.
Yeah, think of like an upside down pyramid, but then if you invert that yes. and make it just a regular looking pyramid.
It's an inverted segmented square flow chart. But in the end, thousands of Irish citizens had invested into the scheme over the years. Apparently about £5 million had gone through the place. A lot of them had made good money in the early years when they had that 20% guaranteed dividend, but a lot of those people tended to reinvest because they were making so much money on it. And then when the whole thing collapsed, everyone lost out.
Yeah.
The Gardaí never found out exactly how much money he'd taken from the accounts and how much he'd actually spent on stamps.
Now, did they know he has a bunch of money in offshore accounts? They're just like, well, sure, that money's gone.
We'll get through his punishment. I think they did find some of the stamps that the robbers had taken, but like at that stage, I think people had realized that they're just little bits of paper to send letters and they're not actually worth anything. But Singer was found guilty and sentenced to 14 years penal servitude, which I didn't think was still on the go in the 1960.
I didn't know that either, yeah. But I wouldn't if... Shit, yeah, you're right. That's like...
That seems
if
crazy.
If that popped up on a Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, like if the four options, and I'm like, right, well, don't mention this one.
Yeah.
In your 50-50, because they'll surely leave it then, because it's such a weird number. Just don't talk about it at all. Have you noticed that? I've been going back through old Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and that's my only gripe with the show.
Oh, really?
Because I do really like the show.
Okay.
But it's just like how everyone says... They're like, I'm kind of between these two. You see, actually, Norm MacDonald has a good clip of it as well, which is what set me off watching old episodes again. But because he's like, he's picking between like whatever the question is, but there's four countries, say like Italy, France, Spain, and Portugal. And he's like, I think it's going to be Spain or Portugal, but I'm going to have to go 50-50 because I'm not sure. But now if I say I'm 50-50 between Spain and Portugal, are you going to... You're going to make sure that they're the two options that pop up. And he's like, no, we don't have access to that. Bang, Spain and Portugal. I would only mention the one that I'm pretty sure that it is. And then just in your head, play that game of, haha, I do know the answer is not this one. I'm only going to talk about this one. And then whatever the other option is, there's your 50-50. Or you lose all your money. I'm not saying that if that show is still on the air, don't go through my tactics. I just like to play the game on my phone.
It was such a stupid name for a show. Who wants to be the millionaire? Who doesn't want to be a millionaire?
Everyone.
Yeah, it's fucking... I don't know anyone's just going to be like, I'm grand. Yeah, billionaires. Like, I don't want to lose that much money. But
also, maybe they do. Maybe they're like, I've lost touch with a common man. How can I afford...
With the common millionaire on the streets.
You can give all of this up for a life of, you know... A regular pension, 40 grand a year. No, hold on a second. Don't go fucking crazy. How about 120 million? How about that?
That's a figure that a man can relax with. But I looked it up there, and apparently penal servitude was abolished officially in Ireland in 1997.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I guess you're not getting sent to a penal colony, but you are being told to break rocks, I guess, on a chain gang. I don't know.
In a quarry.
But it didn't really matter for old Singer because he appealed when it turned out that the foreman of the jury in his original trial had lost money in the Singer auction scheme.
So he couldn't get a fair trial.
He couldn't get a fair trial. I guess that... I don't know what the background due diligence was at the time. Maybe they asked him and he was like, no, I've never seen the man before, and was just like busy during the whole trial writing bastard on a piece of paper. But anyway, so they went for a retrial 2 years after he'd been in prison. The judge ordered like 9 of his charges to be retried. And the second trial lasted 47 days, which was apparently the longest criminal trial on records at the time. And it ended with the court throwing it out, ruling that there was insufficient accounting evidence and Singer was found not guilty on all charges.
Was, wait, but then that means short, like, he'd been onto the jury, they, or else they had faith that they were still in the scheme and they were like, no, it's like all good stock. Yeah, you gotta let it sink to rock bottom before it comes shooting back up.
Now it's time to buy when it's at bottom low. I don't know what happened. I don't know if they threw out all the evidence after, like, they thought they had him, and after the first trial, they just threw it all in an incinerator, and then when it came time for the retrial, they're like, I don't know. He did the bad thing, put him in jail. But
I guess the evidence are, a lot of it would be stamps as well.
A lot of it's probably the books.
That they didn't have access to.
I don't know, maybe he didn't get a fair trial the first time, and people were just so annoyed, they sentenced him. But in reality,
I assume he didn't get a fair trial. But also, no. I mean, that is probably a fair trial because it sounds like he definitely did this.
He definitely.
So a fair trial would be one where he would come out as guilty in the end.
Yeah. I don't know if what he did was illegal because he did buy stamps.
It's not so much illegal as it is frowned upon by the lawmakers of the country.
Yeah.
It feels like it's definitely illegal.
Yeah, but then again, was buying stamps.
I don't understand,
like,
money.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't understand, like, money and taxes and tax evasion and stuff like that. Like, do you remember when Jimmy Carr got in trouble years ago over in England for, like, funneling all of his tax money through, like, an offshore account and only paying, like, a couple of pounds in tax?
Yeah.
I thought that was illegal. And then everyone gave him so much shit and they talked about it on 8 out of 10 cats and, like, it was a big deal for a year or two and then it went away and it turns out it was just frowned upon.
Oh yeah, it's not illegal. Like, yeah, it's just, it's tax. Yeah. What is it? There's two different ones. There's evasion and avoidance. So he's not hiding it.
And he was avoiding.
Yeah, he's just avoiding it, yeah. So it's legal, but it's using a load of loopholes to avoid paying tax. But you're not doing anything illegal, just immoral.
How do I get that?
Well, as he said, I remember the time, when you get to that level of wealth, you pay an accountant to do your books for you. And at some point they'd be like, hey, Jason, do you want to save a load of money? And you're like, yeah.
Yeah. They're like, do you want to pay this much in tax or this much? They're both legal. I'll take the smaller number of things.
Yeah. Or you could just pay your fair share and still be happy with your millions and not be a bollocks. But
or you could be like me. I still owe the tax man, I think it's like €400 from 2015.
And I'll be damned if they get it.
It was an accountant mess up from the place I was working at the time. I'd already accounted for not paying that money. Now I can't go back to that, like, mindset of going, like, I'm just going to have a spare £400 and just hand it over to the government for what? For taxes that I was legally meant to pay in 2015. No,
absolutely not. You should have been gone out of the country most of the time.
Yeah, I haven't been availing of the services.
And should the amount of money you pay in taxes on pints... They should be coming to you, thanking you.
Yeah. I was busy not paying tax in America.
Yeah. Listen, baby, I don't pay taxes in a lot of places, all right? You're going to have to join the queue. So unlike Singer, the ringleader who was now free after 2 years, the Shanahans were charged...
Do you mean the sing leader?
The sing leader, the choir master. The Shanahans in the end. Well, I guess it wasn't that. So Desmond Shanahan is sentenced to 15 months for conspiracy and fraud. Himself and his wife and the father lose the business. And eventually, when he gets out of prison, they all move to England to avoid the shame. And I guess their auctioneer business is gone.
Now, so they must have known in the beginning, or not the beginning, but as they were... Now, maybe they knew from the beginning. But that this was all just a fancy scheme. And then when they were buying from their own auctioneer house just to keep the value of them up.
Yeah.
At that stage, they knew something was wrong.
That's it. I mean, and so they're interviewed.
They kept trying to pull the wool over the whole nation's eyes. Yeah. So I'm not trying to jump to conclusions and, like, put two and two together and get every Shanahan that's left down in Waterford's an absolute bastard. But
in Dunleary.
And I'm just going to, like, Waterford, the Dacia, it's a big county for Shanahans. I think that's maybe where the name came from.
Okay, more like Shanahan, that's all I'll say.
Ho-ho.
But, I mean, apart from all the rest of this episode. But, they're interviewed in that documentary. There's footage of them being interviewed from the 90s, and they're kind of like, you do feel sorry for them when they're telling, because they're old at that stage, and they just talk about how Singer came in, this flash, fly-by-nightly bucko from Central Europe with his polished teeth and big wristwatch and took them for all they want. But you're right. I mean, they did help keep this whole thing going. And they must have known at some point that it was just a house.
Because he didn't have any money.
No.
So, like, if he didn't have the money to buy them,
But it,
he was making them get them.
Yeah, but if they're...
And then surely they would have been like, all right, how do we get out of this? He's like, okay, get ready to move all of your assets to England in a cloud of shame.
Well, like when he said that they're buying, their auction house is buying their own stamps, I assume they're just like, oh, that one sold for €1 million. There's no money being changed around. They just released the information.
Yes, that's usually how those deals would work. I mean, I know this through like football transfers, but yeah, usually that they wouldn't probably show for it at any point.
No, they don't need to prove anything.
Or else it could be used as a way to, like, if someone else had all the money for something previous, that they could end up using that as in, like, okay, well, how about you buy this for €1 million?
Yeah,
or say that you will, and then we'll figure it out down in the. Yeah, I don't know enough about money. I know enough about like how to whitewash money.
Yeah, but. So, after he was released, Singer said, I don't know what a Bratislavan / Swiss / Austrian / London / Irish accent would sound like, but I imagine he said,
well, lad,
how are you? I'm certainly a poorer man than I was when I first came to this country, but I'm a happy man, and a tired one. If the people of Ireland will have me, I would like to stay here. You know, I can relate to Ireland what Austin Chamberlain once said about France. I love Ireland as one loves a woman, and I love her even more because of her faults.
I love Ireland like I love... like what? That is not... It was like, Ireland, it should be talked to once a week. It should be...
No, he loves Ireland like a woman.
I'm going to go down to the pub and leave Ireland back in the house for about 6 nights of the week. Yeah. And then 1 night a week, I'll go around to see Ireland's mother. We're going to England? Ah, fuck.
Yeah. Because he talks about, you know, he talks about helping to get the money back to the people of Ireland. There's still, he sort of claims that it was an honest mistake. He was spending the money. The reason the £1 million is missing is because it was invested in the stamp books and the stamps got stolen. And it was all a misunderstanding, and he's going to help sort it out. He's going to stay in Ireland if we'll have
him. Misunderstamping.
A misunderstamping. But so even though he was acquitted, he still had questions to answer in court regarding the bankruptcy of Shanahan's. So instead of doing all the things he said, he himself and his wife Irma disappeared in the middle of the night out of the country to escape bankruptcy.
Flee.
They went. So apparently people lost track of him for a while, but he showed up in Toronto, Ontario, where he was just right back to business.
Straight back into stamps.
I don't think he did stamps, but apparently he sold Get Rich Quick Scheme books. Which is great.
A book. It's called How to Ruin an Entire Nation's Economy for Dummies.
Yeah. Well, so that's the end of him. Then he died in Toronto, Ontario, on the 23rd of February, 1985. Which is his anniversary in a couple of weeks.
Ooh, commemorative stamp. is there anything to be said there for a commemorative stamp?
There has to be. Yeah, amazing. What should? Yeah, there you go. That's the man who scammed the nation with stamps.
Hmm. Fool me once, shame on me. Mm. Fool me twice, you get a stamp.
It's funny, the whole way through the documentary and like different bits you read, it really was like they just, no one in Ireland had seen anything like this before. Like a smooth talking flash salesman. He's like,
I know,
the monorail man from The Simpsons. We were just like hoodwinked by the most base level of like a guy who seems to have money.
Yeah.
He'd probably be doing cartoonish things like dropping a tenner on the ground and somebody would be like, Mister, you dropped your £10 note. He's like, oh, that? Oh, listen, you have it. And like that'd be all the money he'd have for the week, but that story would travel through the town like wildfire.
He'd be robbing that lad later on that
day. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Follow him home.
Just pure Ponzi scheme.
We don't really have there's Sean Quinn, but that's obviously that's a much more recent story. But yeah, like a story of famous Irish conmen. We're kind of known, I think, in the States through, like, you know, you see, I don't know if Liam Neeson's character in The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is Irish, or else it's just Liam Neeson doing Liam Neeson's accent. But
yeah,
like, he's kind of a con man there a little bit. There's a few around that you're like, I could see snake oil salesmen, like lads with tonics that are going to cure all.
Yeah.
You'd see a lot of those being like hoodwinky Irishmen.
But a lot of it is like sell magic beans and then move on.
That's not in Ireland.
No, it's not in Ireland and it's not long term. It's just, yeah, you're out, in and out. You're onto the next
thing. Yeah, it's not hang around.
Or, as we talked about a bit in the Film Club episode, Mr. O'Reilly from Fawlty Towers.
David Kelly.
Yeah, David Kelly's character in Fawlty Towers. That's that sort of con man where you're like, oh, just playing ignorant and like doing a shoddy job, or, you know, oh, it's, that's going to cost, you know, that'll need parts, big parts, shipped in from America. Won't be cheap now, Mr. Fawlty. Like that sort of low-level haggling and scrabbling.
Yeah, we're not thinking about that. Yeah,
so he'll come in and paint your fences, but you might be short a chicken or two when he's leaving, you know, but innocent stuff.
Yeah,
hijinks,
not a stamp,
not stamps,
not a stamp thief.
No.
Oof, yeah, that's why I don't like. Okay, now you're going to explain to me what NFTs are.
I actually today I met up with someone and they were showing me a book that they bought called Blockchains for Dummies, and it was just like a baby's book. It's like a big colorful children's book.
Okay.
Well, okay, you say what you think it is, and then I'll say what I think it is.
Okay, it's an individual one-off art piece, but it's created as a digital like image. That's like the NFT that you get.
Yeah.
So it's basically just the same as if you take an art piece, like a, you know, like say the Mona Lisa. Someone drew that one time, and there's one of them, so it has this value. Same thing for NFTs. It's just like a digital version of it. But then there's a problem because the value of it's set by A, the people who are just putting numbers on things, or the artists themselves who are just putting it up. So basically it's become like ostensibly a really expensive way to market merch that you're telling people in future will hold a value that there's no way of actually knowing if that's true or not, because there's no like gold standard for it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
have I got it right?
As far as I know, yeah. Like the NFT is what, non-fungible token, and it's as part of blockchain technology for making cryptocurrencies. This is all just like pure jargon. Yeah,
it's guaranteed.
It's guaranteed.
Guaranteed.
But it's, yeah, so to make the blockchain is like a non-fungible, I think just means like you can't change it. And it's because it's part of a blockchain, if you changed it, it would be obvious, whatever way the fucking thing reads. And that token can be a link, and the link is to a painting. And yeah, if I created a replica of the Mona Lisa, it's not worth, the Mona Lisa is worth whatever, hundreds of millions. If I made an absolute replica of it, or have someone made that for me, it may be worth like a couple of hundred, but it's not worth anywhere near the original, even though it could be in better condition, because we've all as a society arbitrarily decided that the other one is worth an awful lot more. It's the same thing.
Yeah. And unless something weird happened where it was like, Rembrandt was a painter that copied stuff, was he? Or I know that I've always heard that term.
Yeah.
I know he also painted a lot of his own stuff as well. But like the idea of like if you were like the world's most famous plagiarist ever, and then you found the one version of the Mona Lisa that a famous plagiarist made, that might be worth more money than the original itself. But it would have to be something so weird and not the norm for that to happen.
And so like the stuff we've been talking about, a stamp with an upside down plane on it instead of a right way round plane is worth 5 million. Like, why? There's no inherent value in it. So who's to say that an NFT or one of the early NFTs won't be worth money in the future? Or it could just be like the Beanie Babies of its day, or Paul Singer trying to sell, or like any Ponzi scheme. The people that got into it initially made money by selling NFTs to other people down the line, and by now it's just pointless. You're just pissing away big money.
It's by now it's the same as with like Wall Street bets, at that it's all grand. Some people are going to make money right off the back buying like cards, packs of cards basically. That's what I saw people, you know, like it's like the Sour Patch Kids and stuff like that. That's what a lot of people in America were doing. And then they were making some money, and then eventually that kind of dries up.
Yeah.
Because that's not really, like, no one cares. And after the first couple of weeks, people go like, I don't really fucking want stock in AMC or GameStop. What's this about again? Yeah. They're like, oh, it was not for this reason. The purpose initially was for somebody else to make money, or else for, like, it to be, like, seen as a cool cultural movement.
But
the actual, like, foundation in it doesn't really seem to be there, because you haven't involved all the rich people who want to make money. Mm. So then they'll just cut it out.
With something like this, like the fear of missing out kind of overrides logic for a bit. And you're like, fuck.
Yeah, it's like,
fuck, I could make a lot of money here. And people, it is a crypto. People made legitimately lots of money off it. But, well, maybe crypto is different because it does have some uses. Like NFTs are useless. And also, like, objectively, they look like shit.
They look like shit and they are pretty useless. You know, like crypto, it makes sense because you can make a lot of money on it. I just don't know how, and I'd rather spend like time doing other things.
Cryptocurrency can be used as a currency, so you can make money off it, which, you know, but like it has a use. Like NFTs don't have a use. Stamps have a use.
No, but like blocks of gold, like, you know, bars of gold basically be the same thing.
That's
that
true.
It's only there as a gold standard, but we're not using the world in an NFT standard. We're not turning around going like this like portrait that was drew with tea bags, but digitally of Mary McAleese's face is going to be worth $1 million. I don't know if it is. Yeah. I don't know
who's to say.
But when you start to see like celebrities who aren't important or don't really much sway in terms of like if Jay-Z was into NFTs, then maybe there'd be something for it. But when it's like when it's people who have like 10,000 followers on Instagram and they're putting up, go catch my NFT, buy it here, and you're like, is this merch?
Yeah.
Is that what it, like, is it merch? Is it just a way of me to give you money to support something that doesn't actually hold any value other than how much someone's willing to pay for it, which is just basically a way of saying that you like something and you want to support it.
I think a lot of people are...
Also, I do like NFTs because they did teach me that like artists have absolutely no like value in their art once money became a thing. Just for years, it was always struggling artist, be an artist, go pursue your art form and then like not sell out to the man.
Mm.
Like I've heard Blind Boy talk about that before, about not selling the song Horse Outside, like not selling that to a car dealership who wanted the rights of it to change around the names or even just keep the name of those car brands and make an absolute fortune, which they absolutely would have at the time. But he was like, no, an artist wouldn't do that. I can't do that. I always thought, also a silly decision. You'd like the money, take the money. But B, like artists who are making NFTs are just, you're just taking money.
Oh, yeah.
You're just cashing in.
Listen, if I could make an NFT in the morning and someone's going to hand me 10 grand, I'd be like, yeah, fuck, I'll take that.
Yeah, it's all your artistic integrity.
No, if what the NFT just said, this is a scam, and right away as soon as I sold it, I was like, yeah, I just scammed some rich idiot out of 10 grand and I'm going to use that to live comfortably while I make art that I like.
But that's what it seemed, but we're too far into it now, which is also, imagine, like with the stamp system back in the day, when the very first few people who put money into it, oh yeah, you're scamming money from those, and then... Once it's a success and you see idiots on Reddit talking about how much money they made, then a load of the common man just goes and puts in their money. And then you're scamming like normal people.
That's it. Yeah, exactly. Or people pooling their money together to afford these things because they think that they're going to be worth something in the future. Yeah.
Well, and then everyone collectively is a little bit more poor.
Yeah. It's going to finish off with a much more fun scam where I love this story of... Did you ever hear Count Victor Lustig, the man who sold the Eiffel Tower?
No.
Yeah, I think it was in the 1930s, much like the spire.
I thought you were going to say, I think it was in Paris.
Paris. much like the spire of Dublin, the people of Paris didn't really like the Eiffel Tower when it first... I think it was initially put up for World's Fair or something. It was supposed to be temporary, but still there to this day. But in the 1930s... Lustig gathered around a load of scrap salesmen from Paris and brought them into a conference room and was like, right, between myself and yourself, this hasn't been announced yet or anything, but we're tearing down the tower and we need to sell the contract to get rid of the scrap metal. So have your bids in by the end of the weekend and we'll go with the highest bidder or whatever. And then he just took all their money.
And ran away.
He was just some guy. And he was kind of telling them, like, on the sly, he was like, oh, no, between, you don't tell anyone, okay, but this contract could go your way. So he just took all the money. And then because they had bribed, what they thought they were doing was bribing a government official. He was just some guy. But then you can't really go to the cops and be like, I tried to bribe a man who I thought was a politician and I want my money back.
Yeah.
And
oh, my God.
Then the best part is that he tried to do it again. The same thing.
But surely not in Paris again.
Oh, yeah. Say exact same thing. Eiffel Tower again.
Well, I suppose, you couldn't sell the scrap job to people who weren't in Paris. You need, the Parisians. But the same people? No.
No. It's a different group.
Because I would think, I know some people might go, oh, they're not going to fall for it again. Well, hold on.
Yeah.
They've fallen for it once. What's the likelihood of all these other people fooling for this stupid scheme?
Exactly. He's also famous for inventing, I'm just reading this now, I forgot this was him as well, he invented the Romanian box, or the money box scam, where he'd have a machine that he said could duplicate money, and then he'd have someone put in a tenner, and then, turn a handle and crank a machine and it'd beep and buzz or whatever, and then two tenors would come out, and they'd be like, hot dog, diggity dog, what a device, I'll be rich for life. But he would have just loaded it with a tenner.
Yeah.
And then he'd sell it to them and then disappear.
That seems like
That's what...
I'm trying to put my head in the mind of someone in like the 30s, 40s, or wherever. You would be thinking, magic.
Oh yeah. You're like, I've done it. I'm gonna take over the mint. And then you get taken by flim flam artists.
But people still react to like magic done on the street by like trained professionals today.
Yeah.
And they're like, holy Christ, how did you manage to, what did, I know it's not real, but how did you do, I mean, you're so good, it kind of makes me think it might be, they've got a system, it's, none of it's real. I don't know, I don't even watch, because the only reason you're going to watch is to try and figure it out.
I know
the end of it, like I know the end of the thing, you're going to impress me with your cool magic trick, that's not magic.
No thank you, I don't want to be impressed. You can keep your magic money machine, I'm out.
Well, I remember I had a friend who was learning some card tricks once, and he got very good at them, but like, I walked into his house one day, and we were sat around for about half an hour. He was going through one or two tricks, and then at one of them, he did that thing where he was like, oh, this one's not working, and he made me like pull out like seven or eight cards, and he was like, it's not working. Hold on a second, what if I just, and I was like, are you going to go upstairs and get a piece of paper that has all these numbers written down, like all these cards? And he ran upstairs and came down with a folded piece of paper. It was like, check that. And inside of it, yes, it was all the cards I'd picked. I was like, okay, that's very impressive that you can do that. That is like very, I don't know how that's happening. But I called it before you left the room.
Why like, was it out of the room? Surely that ruins the trick because he was not just like scribbling down. Seven hearts, three hearts.
I think
hearts,
he thought that we were going to go up to his room maybe when we were doing, but we ended up hanging out in the sitting room or something instead. Okay. But it was in his wallet. Then he'd meant to like pull it out of the wallet and then take it out of that. But like, but just by the concept of me being able to guess what was going to happen next, even if you've done it correctly, it's not impressive anymore because you've clearly trained to do this. That like, but like, if someone can hold their breath for 2 minutes, I'm like, all right. Is that, are you training to hold your breath? Yeah. Well, that's not impressive anymore. That's like you're doing the thing you're
logic
meant to do.
Of what are you talking about? If someone can like, do something impressive, but they have to train to do it, it's not impressive. You just like it if someone can do it because they like bang their head on a table and now they've got the ability to count numbers.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's cool. Yeah. I'd love to do that card trick with you. And just like hand you actually, check this bit of paper. What does that say? And I just wrote, go fuck yourself on it.
that's a joke I could have.
Yeah, you'd appreciate that. They just throw the cards in the ground. It's like the 52.
But it's 52 card pickup. Yeah. God, I hate that.
What a grim.
Yeah, you never play it again. Somehow. It goes so bad the first time, you'll just never play it again. But you'll make so many other kids do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, because as a kid, I probably saw it on TV. But then when you do it yourself, the other person's like, no, you pick it up, and then you just made a mess in your own house. You're like, no, you said you'd play, so you have to pick up the cards. Ah, shit.
Yeah. Childhood.
Kids have no honor. But anyway, let's finish this episode. Buy tickets to our shows. We'll see you there. Don't fall for any Ponzi schemes. Just buy tickets to Shy Talk, a name you can believe in. It's guaranteed.
Unless if you want to start a scheme of you get two of your friends to go to the gigs, we would give you a euro back from selling those tickets for us. And then you can tell those friends if they sell tickets, you can take that money and give it to us because this isn't no pyramid scheme. We want most of the money for the gigs. Come to the gigs.
Yeah, we'll see you there. All right. Good luck.
Chapter.